If this video is on your For You page, you are not allowed to listen to All Too Well 10-minute version anymore tonight. Nope. Zero. No more for you. Turn it off. You may play at different hours, but tonight, enough.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your yassified version of music news and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica. If you thought we weren't doing an emergency off-cycle podcast, well, you haven't been listening very long. Taylor Swift's Red, Taylor's version from the Taylor Vault, it's out. And you know what? I want to be honest. If you've listened to podcasts, you know I'm a little bit skeptical about the craven business purposes behind the Taylor Swift re-recording enterprise. That said, All Too Well, the 10-minute version, as I was watching SNL this past weekend, it was a transfixing performance, and it really got me thinking, and it just made it very clear that who are we, as longtime podcasters, to not address this titanic cultural event. You know the gang is here. Karen Gans.
What's up?
Joe Coscarelli.
I'm actually surprised we're here. I just want to put that on the record. I wasn't sure. I wasn't going to push you on it. I know we were seeing the same tweets. We were seeing the same comments. I held back. And then you texted about SNL, you emailed, and then here we are.
Lindsay Zolads.
I am here.
On heavy duty the last 3 days.
On the red beat.
New York Times pop music criticism, parentheses, Lindsay's version.
Definitely.
Yeah, I would like to point out that Lindsay's story was the great read today on the NewYorkTimes.com.
All right.
No wonder my mentions were a mess. Yeah. That explains a lot. That explains a lot.
I like to surprise you with that information on the air.
On the air, live.
Yeah.
At the top of the episode, that was Kate Glavin on TikTok with a cautionary word, a word, indeed, a word of caution to all of you, all of us, those people who perhaps are a little too emotionally invested in the saga of All Too Well and what it means for Taylor and also what it has meant to us, for us, and potentially about us. So let's get into All Too Well, which is just the pièce de résistance of this Red reissue or re-recording, sorry. And Joe, to your point, because I have largely viewed the re-releases, the re-recordings as, you know, craven, I don't feel like we have very many minutes of conversation to have about them, generally speaking. But watching that performance on Saturday night got me in my 2012 bag, I have to be honest. I felt torn asunder emotionally. And, you know, if you're following my Instagram stories, a lot of Taylor facial expressions captured on the IG story, right? Important, you know, definitely a couple people hit me back and were like, this is my new screensaver. So, you know, just trying to disseminate that into the world. But it made me feel like not only are there things to say that have not been said, but also all of us collectively, I believe, have a lot of feelings about this particular era in Taylor Swift. I wrote the original review of Red for the New York Times 100 years ago. And also this gave new life. And I think, Lindsay, let's start talking about what you covered in your notebook about this. You talked about the weaponization of memory and reclaiming not just the song and extending it, but also almost the balance of power changing. You want to talk us through that a bit?
Taylor is very fascinated with power. I think we can all agree. You know, I think more than probably most female entertainers of her age, sphere, whatever, like she has this element of power and is always trying to figure out how to wield it and how to wield it in a way that sometimes presents her as this underdog. At the very least, she's interested, I think, in that question. And that was kind of the lens that I was viewing this whole re-release through. I do think something, and I touched on this in the piece, to me, I think there are many quite literally breathtaking moments in this new version of the song in that I literally like gasped the first time I heard a few of these lines. But I think the most pointed one is when she calls out the age gap in this relationship particularly and said the reason for this breakup was that the other person, I did not say his name in the piece. I just want to call attention to that too. That was hard. That was a level of restraint you can write about Taylor without speaking his name. So I will try. But I think that to me is the most revealing lyric in this new version of the song because it shows this way in which she felt powerless in this dynamic when she was in a lot of ways one of the most powerful pop stars in the world at that point. And so that, I guess, was the lens that I was looking through this song. And as I wrote in the piece too, I think is why there people are having an emotional connection to this song. They have, obviously, with the previous version, it is really like tapping into something. Everybody has feelings or reactions about it. And I think a little bit of it has to do with that sort of attempt to reclaim the power balance, which again, I should say, we have not heard from the other party in this too. So there is a question of, does Taylor have all the power now because she's the one telling the story?
He's in the lab with Future as we speak.
I would love it. Let's go.
Wait, so, okay. Now, one thing that your piece made me think about was the difference in my reactions to the 10-minute version as the song, just listening to it, you know, solo, no video, right? And then watching the live performance. Listening to it just purely as audio on the day after it came out, and I think you touched on this a little bit, there was something a little bit unruly about it. It's bigger, it's rangier, it's not as tight. And keep in mind, the original is about 5 minutes long. It's not like the original is some 2-minute and 47-second taut thing. The original is long, but it's coherent. It's very, very stitched together. This felt much more unruly, and you could take that both positively and negatively, but it also didn't quite grab in the same way. I think seeing the side eyes, seeing the kind of performed rage and kind of like almost like a bloodletting on the performance, that's what really drove it home for me.
The way you talk about those facial expressions, the SNL performance reminded me so much of two things. One is the live version of Silver Springs, the Fleetwood Mac song from 97, which is one of the best videos on YouTube, I think. It's different because Stevie has the object of her ire on stage
next,
with her.
Right, next door.
So
next door.
She's right. So she's like sending him these increasingly cutting looks throughout the track. And it's just an amazing performance. But I felt like Taylor was really channeling that with these facial expressions. But also there was the throwback, I felt like, to the 2014 Grammys performance of All Too Well, which I think is probably one of Taylor's best, but specifically when she steps back after, you know, the third chorus and the fourth bridge or whatever, wherever we are in the song. And she did the sort of hair tosses, you know, the like back and forth thing. It felt very much like Queen Easter egg, like a nod to when she was doing this song in real time. But I agree that the live performance has helped. But I also wonder if it's not just us hearing it a few more times, because I had the same reaction, obviously, upon first few listens. But I think a large part of that is because it's taking these left and right turns where we're expecting the opposite, or we're expecting the part we know. And then all of a sudden, there's these variables. And, you know, I think we've tossed around this term before. I've heard from songwriters, demo-itis. You know, you get attached to an early version of the song, or the one you know, the one you hear the most. And so I was very, very, very unsettled hearing this version the first few times, mostly because of the production, but then also because of the extra lyrics.
But now it sort of does feel like the canonical version. And that happened pretty quick, I think.
You think so? Canonical?
Sort of, yeah.
Wow, okay. I'm not ready to go that far.
Okay, I do kind of think that.
Can we be honest for a second here?
Yeah, guys? Yeah, yeah. Go in, because I know where you're at.
No, I don't want to go in. No, I don't want to go in.
Let the editor speak.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm not trying to be inflammatory.
Woo!
For the record, I do love Taylor Swift.
Funk flex ball.
I think this, no, for real, I do. And the song's too long. The performance was over the top for me. I felt like it was too emotional. It was super pitchy. I'm used to hearing Taylor near perfection vocals the
definitely
past few
pitchy
years.
For sure pitchy.
And I was taken aback And I knew it was because it was an overflowing of emotion and not a lack of skill, but it felt like such a performance of a performance, a performance of emotions, you know, meta 10 times back about performance. And more cravenly, this was clearly going to be the narrative around this actor that would surround the release of this project. And to me, it could be more, it should be more. I hate the idea that we're just like relying on this tabloid narrative to discuss this album, which is the pivotal album in her discography. And it's funny because I was having all of these, you know, I'm not going to say negative, but less charitable thoughts. And then I read Lindsay's piece when she filed it on Sunday, because Lindsay is great, by the way, and she files early. I just want to put that out there for everyone.
Oh, jeez. Yeah. Speaking of flex bombs.
Listen, I'm just saying. I went into the piece feeling less charitable, and I came out of it with my mind changed, which is also a sign of great criticism, Lindsay. Like, congratulations, because I thought it was great, and it changed my mind. But so the idea.
Wait, Karen, what's it like to be talking this long and knowing it's all going to get cut? What's that like? What's that like?
Listen, you all just get me before my next meeting. I just, you know, I'm just going to flex as long, like Taylor, as long as I can until I get cut off. But, you know, to me, Lindsay transformed my idea of the song as, you know, overlong. To me, you know, I might say bloated. She would say luxurious, reclaiming space. And I was like, you know what? I can see that. All this extra detail. In the effort of proving, you know, my memory of this is quite sharp and this is the way I see it and I'm reexamining it. And, you know, Lindsay made a great point that in the wake of the Me Too movement, a lot of women reexamine relationships they had when they were younger, finding those power imbalances that weren't necessarily abusive or coercive control, but just uncomfortable and reacquainting themselves with how they would handle that now and forgiving their younger selves. So I see all of this. That was a charitable reading of it. But on the flip side of that is sort of what, John, you were getting at about the larger project overall, which that it's sort of like the most crystallized version of Taylor hell-bent on revenge, Swift, and she will have it at any cost. There's no question now that she is wildly powerful. So to me, this feels like punching down. I guess it's a shorter way of saying what I just said for 2 minutes. And like my other thought when I was watching SNL in particular was that like this is an act of revenge that a person in their 30s would enact. That were Taylor in her 40s, she would not be even looking back at this relationship, that she would be so over it. She wouldn't care about it. She'd be like, I'm confident in the relationship I have now. Let Mr. Actor go do whatever he wants. That this is really the work of art of somebody who hasn't gotten there yet. And I wonder how she'll feel about it in 10 years.
So you're saying this is team petty, basically.
I don't know if I want to go that far. I have mentions as well that I care about. I will just say that there are various ways of reading this that are, you know, some are more charitable than others. And while I enjoy the exercise of this and all of the power rebalancing that Lindsay argues is happening in the song, I can also see it from another side, which is like, I can't believe she came back to this. Why didn't she let it go? The first version of the song really is perfection. And it is. It's great. I cannot say that this is, the new one is the canonical version, John. That seems crazy.
Yeah, that seems insane. I'm curious about this idea that this is something that she is doing to him. I think that's loaded. It's a valid read especially because she knows the effect that she has on her fan base in particular. And, you know, it again reminds me of Lemonade and the sort of seeking out of the real people involved there, but.
Or the Scooter Braun sicking the fan base on Scooter Braun.
I mean, but that was literal. She said, tell him how you feel.
But what's the difference between literal and figurative in this moment?
One is art. Is the difference. So like, you know, I don't like these songs. Are these songs? And Lindsay, I thought your piece did this really well. Like, is this song about a man? Is it a breakup song? Or is it a song about memory? I wanted to ask you specifically, Lindsay, you called it bitter in your lead, I think. And I went back and forth on this a lot. I've always thought of it as nostalgic pretending to be bitter, but I think it could also be seen as bitter pretending to be nostalgic. And I wonder where you landed on bitter.
The new version of it, there's so many different emotions that she kind of passes through on this journey. She's got 10 minutes, so it's got a lot of time to get there. So I find it hard to even sum the song up in a single adjective. Like, I think there's passages that are certainly bitter and angry. And then I think there are ones that are kind of looking back with a sort of romanticized eye at memories that she really did cherish from this time. But I also want to connect, you know, I don't think I got at this explicitly in what I wrote, but in the SNL performances and the side eyes that John was alluding to, like I saw those at Scooter and at the people that own her masters now.
Just to be clear, Scooter does not own her masters. I know that's not what you were implying, but just like it's just continues to be a funny thing as people discuss the re-records. Obviously, it's all aimed at Scooter Braun and Scott Borchetta, but they already flipped the asset, which is another insane part of the world and systems that we live in.
But also, I think that's an interesting read, Lindsay, because if that's right, right? If the side eyes are at that category of person, then Joe, I think that sort of undermines the thing where you're like, oh, but the song is art. The Scooter Braun thing was business, but the sicking people on Scooter Braun is art, but taking shots at the actor is art. And it's not. They're the same thing. They are the same thing. And I understand that we have been conditioned over decades of like pop and rock and hip hop criticism to try to separate these things. But we know that those are functionally the same thing.
And I think especially with Taylor, the business side is always tied up in everything she's doing and something that she wants credit for as well. I think you have to keep that in mind. And that, I think if anything, that's the criticism that she gets and kind of the distaste that certain people have for that stance. She has become very forthright and unapologetic about it. And I admit sometimes I find it a bit much as well. But I think you can't divorce that element from, you know, especially this being in a lot of ways her revenge album, I guess.
Well, that was the ultimate irony to me. Like, this would be this is the pivotal of the re-records. It's almost like
it is the one.
A meta project about revenge inside of it.
But this is my thing. All right. And I'll be interested to see how she handles this when it comes up. To me, the actual bitter Taylor Swift album is Speak Now. You have songs like Better Than Revenge on there, but then you have my All Too Well, Dear John. As good as All Too Well is, I think Dear John is her ultimate breakup song, and it has the guy's name in the title. Like, that to me is a knife of a song. And I just don't know what's going to happen when that comes back around.
Back in a sec.
The holidays are somehow already here, which means big holiday deals are too. Yet most of these so-called deals are actually terrible. So how do you separate a great price from a mediocre discount? Or know if something's worth buying, period? That's where Wirecutter comes in. I'm Nathan Burrow, an editor at Wirecutter, the product recommendation service from the New York Times. Wirecutter makes thousands of independent picks based on real-world testing. We review everything from stand mixers to sneakers. We also track prices, check stock, and vet sellers for everything we recommend. So this holiday season, you don't need to spend hours in line or online to find great deals. You just need a little help from Wirecutter. Take back your time, save money, and skip the stress by visiting nytimes.com/holidayguide.
You're taking me down a dark road, Joe, and I have to walk. I have such a vivid recollection of hearing Dear John for the first time. This is back when Taylor's old publicist would come to New York, play songs, shout out Paula, and we were in some hotel room somewhere in Midtown, and I damn near hit the ceiling. Look, y'all know me. You know I'm good with the poker face when I have to be in those kinds of settings. You know, it's like, we're not here to take sides. We're not picking, you know, we're not fans. We're just here to do the work. I almost like upended the conference table. You know what I mean? Like, it was such a radical song. It was so intense and so merciless. And Joe, I don't know if it's my All Too Well. It's almost in another category entirely. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's All Too Well is a Taylor Swift song that is so laser focused on the details of a breakup. Dear John is like a crime in most countries.
Yeah, it's Takeover, it's Ether, yeah, it's all that combined.
Yeah, like I feel like if you released Dear John in like most European countries, like, you'd be in prison for 5 years.
I look forward to this podcast when we do have this hot podcast.
From prison. From prison. Okay, I have some questions about the specifics of the All Too Well re-record and video, sort of like speed round. Do you believe that all the new lyrics that are not in the original are in fact period original?
No.
You think that there is some finessing being done?
I think very slight, but yes.
Okay.
So there was a blog post about specifically whether F the Patriarchy was in popular parlance at the time. I searched Etsy for these keychains
because that you that and me
felt,
both
that felt like the place they would be, and already they had been SEO'd to death with, yes, Taylor Swift merchandise. So it's impossible to tell that way.
Okay, wait. Can I just amend this? So, my dear old friend Elizabeth Spiridakis, she and I were DMing about this, right? And I was like, what I need is someone, it could be Elizabeth, it could be someone who's listening. I need someone to get into the Wayback Machine, right? I need someone to do some deep archive digging and find me the 2011 page of some Etsy seller making F the Patriarchy keychains. That's what I need. That's my definitive proof. So I would like to know if that's real. And if anybody wants to take on that task, I'd be certainly curious to know the outcome.
It's not me. I've been saying it since my freshman year of college, so I can't. I'm
but
not.
Were you making keychains? Okay, okay, were you making keychains though?
I think I would have thought that purchasing a keychain about it was
gauche,
a capitulation to capitalism.
Oh, and thus so you
the patriarchy itself? Yeah, I wasn't on Etsy.
The only other semi-forensic thing I'll say is, if you guys recall, the release of Lover came with some diaries and there was handwritten lyrics, and there was All Too Well lyrics written by hand, you know, words crossed out, etc. It wasn't all of them. There was some stuff I believe that's not in the original one, but there was no trace in that diary of anything we hear new in this song. Now, that's not to say they didn't exist. Obviously, if you're Taylor, you're thinking far enough in advance that you don't want to give away the, you know, maybe this was before the Masters thing, but you're not going to give away if you're ever going to release the extended whatever. There are certain phrases here that felt newer to me, but you know, what is time?
You know, one thing I will say in my research, I believe there's an interview with Liz Rose where she mentions that it was explicit, that there was like swearing in it, like early on.
So which I don't obviously know Taylor that, had not done at this point in her career.
So I would have to look this up again because I read many articles about this song in the past few days. But at the very least, she was on record going into that or much earlier. There is documentation of that.
If she indeed did write new lyrics in the style of early 2010s Taylor Swift, if that's indeed what happened, this is also something that Drake recently did.
Yes.
This is on the Nicki song?
Yes, you're talking about Seeing Green.
Yes, where he's like goes back and basically like heart, you know, like almost like Heartbreak Drake era, kind of.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So if that's indeed the case, then the two kind of canonical stars of this generation going back and reaccessing old flows, old patterns, old thoughts, old feelings. There's a notebook. Okay. So I'm throwing it out there.
While we're on the topic of new versus old lyrics, can we add to your speed round thing, which verses or lines in the new stuff work for you and which don't? Lindsay, do you like the F the Patriarchy verse?
That is not my favorite line. I think that it's one of my least favorite lines, actually, I'm going to say. because that's the very beginning of the pivot into the new stuff, right? And I, like you, Joe, I've worn this song out in the past 9 years. So I was it's very jarring the first moment that something new comes in, especially the first times that I was listening to it. And the fact that it's such a kind of attention-grabbing lyric that, like, I was just like, I think it added to the disorientation of just like, what? What's going on here?
I like that lyric. What I don't like is there's like kind of the pause between patriarchy and keychain.
I knew you were going to say that. Yeah.
But it's confusing. It's a confusing lyric.
It's confusing from a grammatical perspective, but also I feel like it's a buildup at the patriarchy. And I'm like, oh, it's going. Like, we're a takeoff. You know what I mean? Like, we're like whatever the Elon Musk Mars thing is. Like, we're going there. And then it just stops. And then it retreats. And it gets smaller. And I feel like from a musical perspective, I found that disorienting.
Karen, did you have a liner that you either loved or hated from the new stuff?
Not really.
Wait, the secret O thing? Lindsay, you pointed this out. The secret O thing. Woo!
You kept me like a secret, but I kept you like an oath. That's,
damn.
To be able to kill that darling is, I mean, yeah, you know. You're elite. You know you're elite.
I really like just, it's simple, but when, you know, she's something about they're in the car and she's thinking he's going to say it's love. You never called it what it was. The like pivot to the second person in there. And also just that line is very good and kind of speaks to, you know, what I was writing about of like the two differing subjective experiences of this relationship and how something could have been love to her and possibly not to someone else is like the great tragedy of this Greek tragedy of a song.
Something that approached Dear John status for me was you charmed my dad with self-effacing jokes.
Yes, sipping coffee.
Like you're on a late night show. Like, I mean, brutal stuff.
Although I will say that was one of the few moments during the SNL performance where I was like, ah, you're trying too hard, because it was a little bit like she like did a little eyebrow arch situation when she hit late night show. And it's like, yes, we know that this show is on late. Like, we know it's after midnight. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah.
And it's not that kind of late night show.
Yeah.
It's not the same.
Conflating
late night
two right. different late night
That's
shows.
That's what I'm saying. It's not the same. Okay. So more speed round. In the
not so speedy speed round.
Yeah. Sorry, this is one.
We can't do a speed round.
Okay, the All-Star game takes as long as it takes. That's all I'm saying. Do you believe in the All Too Well video, the grouping of people who are at the dinner? Like, do you believe it? Because that is a very 2021 strategic grouping of people. It's a strategic assemblage, very studied in its diversity. Do you believe that that is an adequate representation of what that dinner was like in 2011?
I don't want to touch that, but I'm curious about Taylor casting a redhead as herself.
Oh my God.
That's
you're gonna
my
leave
casting
me hanging?
Choice.
You're going to leave me hanging like this?
Yes.
Unreal. Unreal. Anyway, I think that that is maybe...
it took you out of it.
it's too generous to what I imagine Circle of Friends was like in that era. That's all.
I hope we bleep that.
Yeah, it's going to be the same thing.
Yeah, we're not saying anybody's names.
Fine. Listen, you can bleep it.
I appreciate that we are a half hour into talking about All Too Well. I have to leave you guys.
Bye.
I just want to say that there are many other songs on the album that I love. And the one that Lindsay put in playlist last week with Phoebe Bridgers.
Yes.
Nothing new. Yeah.
Yep.
We're about to get into it as soon as you slam the door. We're about to get into that.
I mean, I have plenty of other positive things to say. I love you, Taylor Swift. It's been great talking to you guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, Karen. Last speed round, genuinely speed round. Did you guys catch that the book reading in the video is taped at Housing Works downtown?
Yes, immediately.
Okay.
Speaking of books and the dinner party, I want to get to the sort of B-side to All Too Well extended version, I Bet You Think About Me, and those lyrics and how they match up with these. Mm. Because I'm thinking that dinner party is like the same scene she's describing when she does the, you know, this. I think it's like the first verse of I Bet You Think About Me. They sit around talking about meaning of life, the book that saved their life. I hadn't heard of it. You know, she's like doing this whole thing. And then there's the $1 million couch. You know, there's what does she call him? Mr. Superior Thinking.
Something about organic shoes.
Yeah, organic shoes. I mean, Beverly Hills. I grew up on a farm, not a mansion. Like, all that. I mean, that's just, that to me is like, even that song has more Speak Now energy than All Too Well for me.
Do you get the sense that some of these songs are maybe not actually red effluvia, but they actually are, they are period fungible, basically?
Not so much. I will say I enjoyed the stretch of vault material on this release much better than the Fearless one. And I think that it is more interesting in terms of someone who wants to watch where she's come from and where she's going. Like, I think there's that song Girl at Home that feels very pre-1989, the kind of synth pop. I do like that one a lot. And then there are kind of, like you guys are saying, that I think ones that harken back to previous more country versions of her as well. Like, I think the reason that this is my favorite Taylor Swift album is that it kind of gives you the best of both worlds, and it has all of the messy things that she can do. You know, like, I think maybe that's to me why I appreciate the new All Too Well. Like, it feels of a piece with this record that is just kind of excessive and throws everything at the wall, and a lot of it sticks.
It is the molting and the reemerge. It is both of those things.
Yeah.
The production choices on the Vault material are really interesting. Like what you said, the Elvira, Girl at Home, going sort of crazy dance pop, whatever on that. The pop mix sort of All Too Well, Jack Antonoff 10-minute version thing, you know. And then you have on the flip side, the I Bet You Think About Me, Aaron Dessner basically doing what I heard as like 2002 Saddle Creek. I put that on my Instagram. You know, it sounds like Lifted or Arab Bright Eyes or Rilo Kiley to me. You know, so you're getting a lot of different sounds in this back half of the 30-track version.
Karen mentioned before she left the Phoebe Bridgers duet, and this is nothing new.
It's like I can feel time moving. How can a person know everything at 18, but nothing at 22? Will you still want me when I'm nothing new?
I think the lyrics of this are very powerful song, especially kind of in the wake of the Taylor and Olivia Rodrigo moments in the last 12 months. I have some temporal confusions with this song that I'm finding it hard to get over, even if I like the song kind of on a pure aesthetic level. It's Taylor writing in the mindset of where she was 10 years ago on a song that did not come out, re-singing it as an older person, duetting with one of her spiritual children who is living in the present. So it's Taylor living in the past, duetting with someone living in the present, but the song doesn't necessarily acknowledge the tension of that. It was a little Black Mirror-y to me. I found it hard to just lose myself into it because the two coexisting temporal spaces felt at odds to me.
I would argue that it does address it. I think it's like, it's between every line, you know? I think like the...
It's not overt, though.
Then the specific verses that they trade, and then the way they sort of alternate on the bridge. Yeah, it felt like a little bit Ghost of Christmas Past speaking to each other.
Maybe I wanted something a little bit more like, Does He Love You? Like Reba and Linda Davis. Like, kind of like something, you know what I mean? Like something going like a little bit like back and forth. Like, it's like we're fighting here.
I know that Phoebe is earlier in her career than Taylor, but they're only 4 years apart in age. Like, I think I would have that problem with it if she was like, if it was Olivia Rodrigo in the song. But I see them almost more as peers, just on a kind of emotional level, if not necessarily career-wise. But obviously, you know, the subtext of Phoebe kind of having this big blow-up year and probably wondering, you know, where she goes from here. Definitely comes through on that. Yeah, I didn't necessarily have that issue with it.
I guess I'm just out floating alone in my confusion with this song. I also feel like, and I feel, did I say this on a previous podcast or maybe even in a playlist? But like, there's something a little bit odd to me. Taylor has not had like a robust history of duetting with women. That's not something that comes up a lot. And when she does, they often are, it's not on equal footing.
Yeah, background vocals.
Yeah. And so the idea that Taylor embraces Phoebe Bridgers, but also is like, you can duet with the 2012 version of me, not the 2021 version of me. Like, there's something feels a little bit like I'm the boss here kind of energy. That feels strange to me. Like, if you really bang with Phoebe Bridgers, do a record with her, like a real record, a new record.
This didn't feel like little sissing her to me.
It's conceptual. It's not literal. It's conceptual.
Yeah. If it was Olivia Rodrigo, it would be different. The other thing is like Phoebe Bridgers is like famous on our Twitter feeds, but she is not like Taylor Swift level famous by any stretch of the imagination.
I totally agree. Just something, this song itched in a way that none of the other songs did.
I think their partnership on this is poignant, and the meta-ness of it was clever. But I am, while we're on the subject, I'm interested in this idea, and given the week that we're in, someone tweeted that Adele and Taylor Swift are like a year apart in age, which is totally mind-blowing when you think about their careers and just their songwriting. I don't know. Like, yes, they're essentially the same age.
Wait, can you unpack that a little bit?
I guess we've known Taylor throughout her whole career, which makes it, you know, child stars are always different. But I just feel like Taylor is inching into adulthood for like the last decade, whereas like Adele arrived like a 52-year-old
yes.
torch singer.
Yes,
you know?
She was all, yes, I was reading some old thing I wrote. Oh, in the Red Review, talking about it. Yeah, talking about Adele and basically like Taylor was still navigating how to bridge being kind of like wide-eyed and young with like representing actual adulthood in the songs. And then I think there's a parenthetical in there, which basically like, unlike Adele, who basically has been old since before she showed up and kind of like was always making old.
While we're music. Here, I just want to give one Red memory, John. I don't know if you'll remember this. You and I in 2012 were, you know, friendly acquaintances. We're not working together, but I do remember seeing you after We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together came out. And, you know, we were both sort of mind blown at the direction she was taking, but you had heard the album and I hadn't. And you said, no, that's not even the one. Just wait until you hear the dubstep drop.
Yeah.
And so I had been primed for that, but I was transported in listening to this re-record to sort of being like, what could Taylor Swift possibly do that's crazier than We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together?
Should we go out on that?
I Knew You Were Trouble. Why not?
I was thinking about that too. People were scandalized by that dubstep drop in 2012. Like, I kind of want to go back to that time when the worst thing that could happen was Taylor Swift doing a dubstep drop, which, like, it doesn't even sound like dubstep to me now, too. I don't know if it's just because everything that, like, but that was like a talking point. That was a thing.
It was really a thing.
Joe, Lindsay, Karen, in absentia, I appreciate y'all calling in. Listen to every podcast ever, nytimes.com/podcast. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com. Get on the Facebook group. Get in the Discord. Subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get audio. Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, Apple, whatever. Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media is our producer. We will be back next week. We all knew that you were trouble. So you put me down.